Revision and development. Unit 89, exercise 7. Our final speaker in the studio of the subject of energy is Joseph Hahn, Undersecretary of Energy.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to join the discussion. First, I would like to thank Professor White of the New England Institute of Technology for his valuable contribution to the discussion. It's also a pleasure to express my thanks to Jane Black, the representative of the CANE, the Campaign Against Nuclear Energy, for her emotional warning on the harmful use of nuclear energy. I also acknowledge with gratitude and affection the brilliant proposal on the use of alternative resources expressed by Dr. Catalina Burgos, the author of several books on alternative technology. I've been listening to her now with great interest. By the way, I don't agree with some of the estimates of the world energy resources. There's no cause for concern as far as fossil fuels are concerned. Let me assure you that more oil and gas is being discovered all the time. If we listen to the pessimists, and there are a lot of them around, none of us would sleep at night. In the short run, we must continue to rely on fossil fuels, oil, coal, and gas. Wouldn't you agree that we must look to the future? It would be in our interest if our policy were flexible. Unless we thought new research was necessary, we wouldn't be spending money on it. After all, we wouldn't have a Department of Energy unless most people thought it was important. The big question is where to spend money, on conservation of present resources or on research into new forms of power. But I'm fairly optimistic. I wouldn't be in this job unless I were an optimist. I can't help feeling that under no circumstances should we come to a hasty decision on that.
Unit 10, Exercise 2. Can the average person really understand science? Does the average person want to know about science? Does science matter to us? The answer to these questions is a resounding yes. For many of us, however, the mere memory of physics, chemistry, and biology classes in high school and college makes our eyes glaze over. We left the classroom with the belief that science was dull and abstract and virtually impossible for the average person to understand. Back then, it wasn't cool to understand science, and it seemed to have little immediate relevance to our lives. Yet, as we matured and headed into the world, we found ourselves face to face with the sophisticated computers at work and frequent headlines about matters of science, mapping human genetic makeup, cloning, test tube babies, and the August 1996 discovery of the possibility of past life on Mars, to name a few. Suddenly, scientific knowledge has not only become acceptable, it has become a useful, essential, and inescapable part of our lives. For some of us, our fascination with science began in the 1950s and the 1960s, when the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, or when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon, striking evidence of man's ability to apply scientific knowledge to accomplish extraordinary goals. For others, all it took to become interested in science was getting out of high school or merely witnessing the unending series of new scientific achievements and inventions that occurred during the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. The Venus landing, fiber optics, deciphering DNA code, black holes, space stations, microchips and computers, microsurgery, the space shuttle, heart transplants, artificial hearts, superconductivity, the discovery of solar systems, and much more. You don't have to be a theoretical physicist to be awed by space exploration or curious about whether life exists on Mars or how the universe began. You don't have to be a biochemist to have an interest in the fundamental processes of life. It's impossible not to be curious about such matters. Scientific knowledge and discoveries are much too interesting and profound to be left only to scientists. Science can be fascinating. Many great discoveries of past have now, in our lifetime, culminated in the most incredible and pervasive scientific and technological revolution that could be imagined. Whether we approve of it or not, we're swept up in that revolution and the resulting culture, unless you live in a cave. Not only is science fascinating, it matters to us because it is our life. They say that whatever road we take, our fate is indissolubly bound up with science. It is essential, as a matter of simple survival, for us to understand science. The more we know science, the better we understand life. It means feeling more comfortable with our everyday lives and using science and technology to accomplish goals. Science is a part of our culture and heritage. It is of great importance for not merely ivory tower intellectuals, but for the masses of average people. Knowledge is our identity. Homo sapiens will continue to search for the answers to new questions. We will develop new concepts, new theories, and we will continue our quest to understand the natural world. We will continue to discover, create, explore, and invent. We will search for the cure and the life-saving solution, for we are the discoverers, creators, explorers, and inventors. We seek the unknown, the deep, the dark, the never-before-seen, and we have within us the capacity for ever greater wisdom. We have come to the future. We have found our place by looking back and understanding history. We are poised to become 21st centurions. As one scientist said, we don't have to look too far to see the future. We can already see it will be magnificent. We have now reached the 15 billion year journey. Exercise 11. Ladies and gentlemen, after having listened to the previous speakers, I understood that we had been quite right, including the problem I called fraud in research, on the agenda. Before I give the floor to Dr. Maureen Walling, I'd like to say that the problem I've just mentioned is getting continued publicity and attracting the attention of not only granting agencies, but even governmental committees. Exaggerated or not, there seems to be a growing concern among the public that all is not well, and the probity of the scientific enterprise is coming increasingly into question. It's not an easy task to introduce a speaker to an audience, especially when she is such an outstanding scientist as Dr. Walling. It's rather like introducing a member to his or her family. I'll, however, be on safe ground, I think, if I content myself by thanking you, Dr. Walling, on behalf of your audience for coming along to our conference, Science and Its Problems, and joining the discussion. Will you address us, Dr. Walling?
Dear Mr. Chairman, dear colleagues, the problem I'm going to speak about must be recognized by all working scientists, and we should take some steps to decrease the frequencies of such betrayals of our scientific ethics. I feel strongly that, at least in my own field of chemistry, two major keys to meeting the problems are simply keeping good records and the proper assumption of responsibility by senior investigators. These are matters on the importance of which we all agree, but their implementation is easily eluded by carelessness, impatience, and the rush to get results. In fact, I'll make no claim to have always been blameless myself. Deliberate fraud by senior investigators is rare, and in academic chemistry, I can't recall a clear-cut case during the 50 years I've been in science. Fabrication of data by students or other junior members of a research group is, unfortunately, not as uncommon and occurs most frequently to meet a deadline, to complete a thesis or publication, or to force recalcitrant experiments to fit some preconceived pattern. To this side of deliberate fraud, there exists, as we all know, a large morass which I may call subjective treatment of data. Into this we all step, and occasionally some of us become badly mirrored. Basically, it involves selecting and arranging data to support a favored hypothesis. Much of this is legitimate and indeed necessary if a comprehensible publication is to be distilled from a mass of data accumulated over a long period. On the other hand, as we grow increasingly enamored with our hypothesis, such selection can easily get out of hand. Since confidence in our own ideas and the ability to present our results in the most favorable light increases with experience, it is here that senior investigators most often go astray. We all have to walk a delicate line, and occasionally step over it. Such overly subjective interpretations of data are probably the major source of the polemics that occasionally burst forth and enliven our science. Some are significant, but many are rather trivial. Although most students and junior investigators intend to be honest, Keeping meticulous records are also a strong disincentive to fudging data. Overlooking inconvenient results and giving undue weight to sloppy or incomplete work. This makes them an important barrier to both fraud and the undue massaging of data in the first place. Not to mention that good records are vital in identifying the source of trouble if results cannot be reproduced or published work comes under criticism. As I said at the beginning, the importance of responsibility and of good record keeping are matters on which all scientists generally agree. I think if we can put our own house in order in regards to them, we'll not only be in a better position to meet criticism, but can significantly decrease the cases of fraud and misinterpretation of data that occasionally arise in our business, and which are currently causing us so much trouble. And to conclude, I should say that this is a much better solution than waiting for some higher power to issue regulations on how we should behave. Thank you for your attention.
Revision and development. Unit 6 through 10. Exercise 10. I just can't help thinking of things made from plastics as imitations, as cheap substitutes.
If by cheap you mean less expensive, then you're quite right. For example, that new watering can we bought for the garden.
Yes, it did cost less than a metal one.
Do you remember why we bought it?
I like the nice bright yellow color, but you can buy colored metal ones too.
Ah, but with plastics, the color goes all the way through, because the pigments are mixed in with the raw materials. They don't have to be painted like metal, and...
Can I interrupt your chemical lecture for a second? It doesn't matter anyway. The result's the same.
No, it isn't. Take a watering can, or a child's toy, or even something you see in the kitchen, like your washing up bowl. What happens when you're knocked against something hard?
You mean if they're metal?
Yes.
I suppose after a while the paint becomes chipped. All right, I see the point. With plastics, the colors won't chip off.
But do you remember another reason why we decided to buy a new watering can?
Yes, certainly. The old one was so rusty. There were holes in the bottom. I see. Plastics don't rust like metal.
Exactly. Are you beginning to feel more kindly towards plastics?
I've nothing against them, Giles, but they are used instead of the original materials, so that makes them substitutes, doesn't it?
Do you remember what Mrs. Harvey said?
Mrs. Harvey? Who?
The plastics expert. You know, the chemist, in the recording I made at the exhibition.
Oh, yes, sure.
And incidentally, my tape recorder wouldn't be so small or so light if it weren't for the fact...
I see what you mean, if it wasn't made of plastics.
You're learning. I'll just run the tape back to the right place. I think this is where it is. Listen.
People who call them substitutes.
Oh, yes. Some still do, but they're quite wrong, Mr. Newton. Plastics are materials in their own right. Cheapness is not the only factor that makes them acceptable to industry. The fart can replace any other material, like wood, metal, or a natural fabric. A plastics material must have a performance that is at least comparable to whatever was previously used.
And I suppose sometimes they're even better.
Particularly when the properties of the materials are adjusted or even created to suit the specific requirements of the end product.
What sort of properties?
The degree of rigidity or flexibility, for example, resistance to acids, insulating qualities, ability to withstand sudden changes of temperature. The list is endless, but the plastic industry is being continually asked to recommend or develop materials for such a wide variety of new uses.
Do they succeed?
More often than not. In fact, there are so many types of plastics with so many unique properties, they frequently provide answers to unsolved engineering problems.
On behalf of our journal, let me express my deepest gratitude to you, Mrs. Harvey, for such a brilliant explanation.
My pleasure.
Well, Susan? Number one.
Who are the speakers?
Number two. Why did they buy a new watering can?
3. Who is Mrs. Harvey?
Number 4.
When did they meet Mrs. Harvey?
Number 5.
What properties of plastics were not mentioned? Number 6.
What things made from plastics were mentioned?
Exercise 12.
Dear colleagues, I appreciate this opportunity to talk about ecological problems in your country where environmental protection is the constitutional duty of every citizen. Interrelations between man and the biosphere are of a very complex nature. Man, like every other living organism, depends for his life on what the biosphere provides: water, oxygen, food, etc. On the other hand, the biosphere is strongly affected by all sorts of human activities. The conflicts that arise in this man and the environment interaction are different. For example, man creates new compounds, new substances, pure chemical elements which are unknown to the biosphere. They do not belong to the natural cycle of matter. They undermine the capacity of natural complexes for self-regulation. Though not changing biologically, we change the medium in which we live. We are polluting ourselves out of existence. Forests are disappearing. Deserts are advancing at the same speed, and if there are qualitative changes in the biosphere, it will no longer correspond to the biological requirements of man, whose ability to adapt is very limited. Your great scientist, Vladimir Vernadsky, was the first to realize the necessity for quite a new approach to the biosphere as early as the mid-40s. It is Vernadsky's concept of the biosphere that we accept today. That we must act now is clear. If your house is in order, you're all right. And I would like some of the Russian environmentalists to share their experiences and speak about how environmental protection is organized in Russia. Paper 2. Section 1. Listening Comprehension. This section of the test requires a demonstration of your ability to understand a lecture or a talk. After you hear a lecture or a talk, you'll have to answer a few questions. The questions and the answers are given to you. Choose the best answer from the four given. Record your answers on the answer sheet.
Plastics. Plastics are organic substances made of synthetically by polymerization and capable of being formed into an almost endless variety of products: threads, sheets, tubes, and molded objects. The ancestor of modern synthetic plastics is celluloid. Celluloid has certain disadvantages: its flammability and the fact that it is not readily molded. Thus, it was not until the discovery of bakelite in 1907 that the real foundation of synthetic plastics industry was laid. Plastics that consist of long chain molecules can be softened by heat and molded into a desired shape. These plastics are called thermoplastic. Plastics in which the polymer chains are cross-linked have much greater rigidity and cannot be softened readily. They are called thermosetting. The terms thermoplastic and thermosetting are also applied to the resins from which plastics are made. The principal agent incorporated in a plastic is the resin. It may be natural, like cellulose, but it is most generally synthetic. The resin is also known as the binder. Substances added to the plastic to enhance certain properties, hardness, resistance to shock, or resistance to abrasion, are called fillers. Examples are asbestos, glass fibers, and wood flour. Plasticizers are also included in the formation. Antioxidants may be added to promote chemical stability and thus prolong life. Catalysts are added to assist the final cure, final formation of the product. The stabilizers to protect against sunlight, heat, and other destructive factors. The procedure used to shape a plastic into its final form depends on the properties of the plastic. Some plastics can be injection molded. Other plastics must be compression molded. After they are filled into the mold, they are subjected to pressure. Certain plastics are simply cast into their final shapes.
1. What does the passage mainly discuss?
2. According to the passage, materials which can be softened by heat and molded into a desired shape are called...
According to the passage, when was Bakelite discovered?
4. According to the passage, what is the principal agent incorporated into plastics?
5. Which of the following will be least useful if it were made from thermoplastics?
6. The paragraph following the passage most probably discusses...
Slide 2.